libertyutilities.com/efficiency. It's 9:06. This is NHPR.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. A new national report puts New Hampshire at the very top when it comes to overall protecting Granite Staters from infectious disease. The 50-state ranking from the Trust for America's Health is based on 10 measures it deems important, from whether HIV screenings are covered under state Medicaid to disease outbreak reporting requirements for hospitals to how well a state's public health lab functions. The Granite State scored well in 8 out of 10 of these. But here's where it gets interesting. The two indicators where New Hampshire falls short both have to do with vaccines. According to the report, we didn't quite meet the federal guideline of 90% of all babies vaccinated for whooping cough, nor did we meet the goal of vaccinating at least half the population for seasonal flu. The statistics reflect in New Hampshire and nationwide a small but ongoing anti-vaccine trend. Even though that infamous British article linking vaccines with autism has been fully discredited and retracted, some parents still have a lurking suspicion. And others, while not believing the autism story, still feel uneasy with the sheer number of vaccines given these days, an ever-growing list recommended for an ever-growing number of Americans, especially young children. Today in The Exchange, we dive into what's behind the vaccine debate, and let's hear from you. Do you avoid all vaccines, or just those for illnesses that seem less life-threatening? And if you're getting all immunizations for yourself and your kids, how do you feel about people who make the opposite choice? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have two guests for the hour. Marcella Babinski is with us, Immunization Section Chief for the New Hampshire Division of Public Health Services. Marcella, it's nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And joining us from Michigan, Mark Largent, Historian of Science and Associate Dean at Michigan State University. He's author of Vaccine, The Debate in Modern America. And Mark Largent, really good to have you too. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, and Mark, I'm going to turn to you first. What shifts in public attitudes have you seen surrounding vaccines in the past 20 or 30 years? You've been looking at this for a while, Mark.
Well, the shifts have largely occurred because of a series of events that took place in the late 90s. The Wakefield study that you just talked about, the British study that was published in 1998, was a sort of focal point for a lot of people, but there had been a much broader growing concern about vaccines, the number of vaccines, what we were vaccinating against, and potential side effects of vaccines that had been lingering in the background. So the Wakefield study was a kind of spark that lit a tinderbox. There had also been in the United States, at almost the exact same time that the Wakefield incident happened, a study that was done of mercury in food and drugs. That was part of the FDA Modernization Act of 1997. And we were surprised to find that there was mercury intentionally being used in a number of childhood vaccines. And people believed that that was imprudent, and the FDA and the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Centers for Disease Control all agreed we should probably get that out. Whether there was a real harm from that mercury or not, we should, as a prudent measure, get it out. So that happened almost simultaneously with the Wakefield incident, or the publication of the Wakefield paper, and with this growing concern, which was wrapped up in an increasing number of vaccines that children get. In the 80s, we really just vaccinated with three principal vaccines, the combined diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus shot, the combined measles, mumps, rubella shot, and the polio vaccine. But beginning in the late 90s, we had added the Hib vaccine, varicella, rotavirus, seasonal influenza, pneumococcal, and hepatitis A. So there were a lot more vaccines being given at a time when there was increasing discussion about potential adverse side effects because of those vaccines.
Yeah, so the number of vaccines has gone up a lot. And why is that, Marcella? Why does it seem that there is this huge, long list now of vaccines that kids get?
I think we are lucky that children are able to receive so many vaccines. Science continues to march on. Vaccines have been developed over the years, and we have now the best of many worlds. There are vaccines yet to be developed, but certainly these diseases cause harm. For some children, for example, chickenpox, varicella, it goes and it passes through, and a child gets it, and they keep going, and there's no big deal.
The rite of passage. That was how it was when we were little, right? Everybody got it, and then you were immunized.
Except at the same time, I was a sick little puppy when that happened. I remember it rather well. And many children are very, very ill when they get something as easy as chickenpox. Every disease affects a child the same way. We know that about many things. Some children they get the disease, they ride it out, they have to stay home from school, and they're back running around. Other children can get the same disease, and they are harmed for the rest of their life, and some die. So as we say, many have developed, and isn't that kind of too bad because it creates more shots in the doctor's office? Wow. We have been able to take these diseases and essentially set them aside so we can raise our children without the fear of having real potential harm for some of our kids with these diseases.
What do you think about the question I asked Mark, shifts in public attitudes that we have seen about vaccines just in the past 20 years, the difference that you see between, you know, the late 80s and the mid-90s?
Yeah, we have had a shift in that. Now we're talking much more about the delay in vaccines. Some people call it hesitancy. Some people call it vaccine delay. So because we have so many, some people are asking their physicians to, can we spread these out a little bit? And I think we're seeing that impact here in the state of New Hampshire. You mentioned the report that came out. That it had a time frame around it, 19 to 35 months. So are some people expanding beyond that 3 years to make sure their children get that diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis shot? Yeah, I think they are. We are spreading it out. And that's one of the issues that we have.
Well, and from a public health perspective, and I want to hear from you too, Mark, on this, but Marcella, from a public health perspective, what's the impact of spreading it out versus doing it on the recommended schedule?
The recommended schedule is essentially scientifically based. We know that the vaccines have been tested for those intervals. We know that they have been tested so that one shot can be given with another shot, and we know that's safe because that has been tested. We also understand that a child who is 1 year of age can be very susceptible to many of these diseases. So let's get these children fully vaccinated. They need their priming shots. They need their booster shots to make sure that as much protection, say 90, 95%, is offered to that child as soon as possible.
Yeah. I'd love to hear from you too, Mark, on this. The effect, the public effect, the individual effect of stretching it out, not doing it as recommended. And then we'll talk a little bit later about the effect of not doing it at all. But go ahead, Mark.
Well, so right now, the vaccines that we give as part of the routine vaccination schedule includes the vaccines that states mandate that children get, as well as a larger collection of vaccines that the Centers for Disease Control recommends that children get. And any particular pediatric practice will develop its own schedule that's usually pretty closely linked to the Centers for Disease Control's recommended vaccine schedule. And there are about 36 inoculations that a fully vaccinated child would need to receive by the time that they're 6 years old. But about 25 of them occur in the first 18 months of life.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. By some people's standards, that is a great deal. And I think Marcel is right. If you look at any one of these vaccines, it's a very, very valuable vaccine. And it's difficult to point to a vaccine and say, I don't want that one, but I do want that one and that one. So the problem is that the individual vaccines are fine. It's that mass, you know, of over 24 shots in the first 18 months of life that seems to bother parents. And so when we look at polling data and we look at the ethnographic studies that are being done, we find that it's the intensity of the number of shots at very particular points. Now, the vaccines have been tested, and they're tested to go together. And we watch very carefully with a passive surveillance system to see if problems arise. And when they do, the public health community and the CDC are very quick to respond to it. But we just have to keep a kind of vigilant watch on if there's any problems that happen to emerge in particular groups or generally. But there's another thing in addition to the science, and that is when these shots have to be given, or when these inoculations have to be given, they're not all shots. Some of them are, for example, nasal sprays, but most of them are shots. And they have to be given in these regular intervals when a child is brought in for a well child checkup. And those well child checkups are established by the insurance industry. Children are brought in usually within 72 hours after they're released from the hospital, and then a week and two and a month, 2 months, 4 months, six, 9, 12, 15, 18. Anybody who's had young children knows about these well-child checkups. What happens is the vaccinations have to be done on those well-child checkups. So as long as you bring a well-child in for a well-child checkup, you can stay on the schedule. And there are a couple of times, for example, at the 2 and 4 month, when you're talking about 5 and 6 inoculations at one visit.
Yeah.
And if a child is brought in with, say, an ear infection, most pediatricians will not vaccinate. And most parents won't want their child vaccinated while they're ill. Then there's arguments about whether or not that's a wise choice or not, but the general practice is to not vaccinate an ill child with anything more than a very mild illness.
And then
so
the whole schedule
you
gets
back
off.
Up.
Yeah.
What happens is then you're now behind, and so you're doing catch-up. And so it's that intensity on those moments of those well-child checkups that seem to really trouble parents.
I want to talk about that a little bit more in a minute. But, Marcella, a big concern that we are seeing as some parents choose not to vaccinate at all. Okay, I'm not talking about stretching it out or changing the schedule, but not at all. The Keene Sentinel had an editorial just recently on how we're seeing more whooping cough now. We thought we were done with that, but we're seeing more whooping cough around the country. How come?
There are many theories, many reasons we think that we're seeing more and more whooping cough. And yes, we are. I mean, California, Washington, and other states throughout the country have had outbreaks. I mean, nigh on epidemic levels.
And we thought we were done with this, right?
We'd hoped to be done with this, absolutely. So a few things have happened. One theory and one certain probable reason is that the pertussis vaccine, the whooping cough vaccine, it's contained in what we call DTaP, which also contains diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, whooping cough. That has changed in the last few years. It used to be another type of vaccine, but that's changed. So we're finding that that's not quite as strong as we would like it to be.
All right. A little bit more after a short break, Marcella. And Mark, I want to hear from you, too. We're going to take a short break now, though, and check in with our December Fun Drive.
And you're listening to The Exchange here in NHPR. It is our short December Fun Drive. We're asking you to step forward now and do your part to make programs like The Exchange, The Diane Rehm Show, and Morning Edition possible. It's all thanks to you when you make your contribution at 1-888-805-6477. You can also support your favorite NHPR programs online at nhpr.org. This is a great time for you to support The Exchange, by the way, because for the next 40 minutes, that's how much time you have left to get entered in to win $600 in gift cards to Burke Jewelers, West Pearl Street in downtown Nashua. It's a great opportunity to pick out something from under the glass or design your own with today's drawing prize. And you'd also enter into all the other great drawings for the rest of this December Fun Drive, including the Bose radio and CD player that we're giving away later on today. You don't have to support NHPR to get your name in the hat for these drawings, but while you're on the phone or on the web, we hope you'll take a couple of extra moments as well and support programs like The Exchange on NHPR. Again, the deadline is 10 o'clock, though, to enter the drawing for the $600 in gift cards to Burke Jewelers. Let's hear from you now at 1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org.
Support all of the conversations that you hear on programs like The Exchange. This is the state's only statewide news program, call-in program, where you can weigh in with your opinions on the issues and the governmental politics and the goings-on that are circulating around the state. That is why you depend on The Exchange. Your voice gets entered into the conversation of what's going on in New Hampshire. Well, all of the voices in New Hampshire are represented on New Hampshire Public Radio, and we hope that you can also support this station, not just with your voice, but with your financial support. Call us at 1-888-805-6477. 6477 or nhpr.org.
Making good progress on the goal for this hour. $2,900 now to go on the goal for this hour before 10 o'clock. We do need to reach this goal, actually go past this hour's goal if we can. We're a little bit behind where we thought we would be at this point in the drive. It's been a very busy week. The holidays coming right up. We have had some snowstorms in New Hampshire. We understand there's been a lot of distractions, but right now you're listening to The Exchange. You've been meaning to support NHPR during this short December fund drive. Now is the perfect time to do so. Call 1-888-805-6477 or donate online at nhpr.org.
Listener support makes up just over 41% of all of the revenue for NHPR. So getting more members, just even 1 or 2% or more of the audience, would make a really big difference in our ability to serve you even better. You can call us now with your support. Weigh in on New Hampshire Public Radio's December Fund Drive, 1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org.
And when you go to our website, nhpr.org, or when you call right now, 1-888-805-6477, you're automatically in the hat to win a really great drawing prize, $600 in gift cards to Burke Jewelers in downtown Nashua. Not only are you in the drawing for this prize, you're entered into the drawings for the rest of the short December fund drive, including for the Bose Wave radio and CD player that we're giving away a little bit later on today. But to win either of these great prizes, we need to have you enter the drawing. 1-888-805-6477, nhpr.org. Again, the deadline to enter the drawing for the $600 in gift cards to Burke Jewelers, 10 o'clock this morning. Don't put it off any longer. 1-888-805-6477, nhpr.org.
No matter why you listen to NHPR, maybe there is a way that you would put it. How would you say you support NHPR and why? Well, Derek from Warner says, I'm a pizza delivery driver and I get all my news for the day from NHPR. Becky from Concord says, my day would be boring without NHPR. Sudhakar from Bedford says, great programming. And I love this. Cynthia from Center Ospey says, I live here. That is why I support New Hampshire Public Radio, because it provides me with news and information about my direct community, about the state, about the world that we live in and the country that we live in. Call us at 1-888-805-6477. Think of your own reasons of why you listen to New Hampshire Public Radio and make a choice to support it.
$2,700 to go on the goal for this hour. Web pledges coming in, calls coming in. Keep them coming at 1-888-805-6477 or give online, nhpr.org.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our members, and from nearbyregistry.com, an online marketplace of local shops, boutiques, and nonprofits for weddings, baby showers, a wish list. More information available at nearbyregistry.com. From Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, Electric, and now offering electrical repair and service in addition to furnaces, boilers, and water heaters, online at justcallheritage.com. And The Telegraph, providing local news coverage and advertising opportunities for today's complexities, online at nashuatelegraph.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, once again, we're looking at the debate, some of the anxiety over vaccinations, why the controversy, the benefits and risks. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have two guests for the hour, Mark Largent, historian of science and associate Dean at Michigan State University. He's the author of Vaccine, The Debate in Modern America. Also with us in studio, Marcella Babinski, Immunization Section Chief for the New Hampshire Division of Public Health Services. And both of you, let's go to our listeners now, people who want to jump in on our conversation. Abby in Concord has been waiting. Hi, Abby. Thanks for hanging on. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I'm a public health professional, and I'm definitely in support of vaccines for several different reasons, but my question is really kind of something that's been increasingly troublesome to me, is the kind of proliferation of the misinformation because of social media. I see, just on my own newsfeed alone, a lot of kind of anti-vaccine messaging that kind of people will share without understanding the true story, or I'll see a headline that is really taken out of context. And I'm curious how social media has really changed the way vaccine advocates have to address awareness and outreach to make sure that the correct information is out there, and how, you know, we as kind of consumers can, who are aware of, you know, the benefits of vaccinations, can kind of negate some of the misinformation that's out there in our own daily lives.
Abby, it's a good question. I want to hear from both of you. Mark Largent, how about you first? The proliferation of ways we can communicate with each other.
Well, this is something that has really troubled public health officials over the last 15 or 20 years, especially as the Internet has become an easier pathway to gain access to this information. If you look at the anti-vaccine rhetoric that existed prior to the late 90s, early 2000s, it was usually located in bodies of literature like natural health literature, or in some cases more extreme right-wing literature, political literature, or in religious, and I would even call it church-based religious, but sort of a general religious resentment against modern medicine kinds of discussion. And so you had to go physically, you had to go particular places to find it. Now you just go to your computer. It's relatively easy to access. Now, that being said, lots of stuff is much easier to access now, and it's much easier to get instant access to very authentic information that's supported by places like the Centers for Disease Control. What we find when we watch people work their way through the Internet looking for answers, so we take a young parent and we see that they're nervous and we see what they do, they go to the websites that are supportive of vaccines and they see what they say. But they feel like, and we know this from interviewing them and from watching how they click through the pages, they feel like they're not getting the whole story. So they go looking for other information, for something that seems more balanced to them. What they end up with is the same thing that we have going on in the public discourse, which is two completely irreconcilable statements. You have one set of pro-vaccine voices that have an ideology that says the vaccines are really valuable for not only an individual's health, but for the public health. They have anecdotes to support that, and they have evidence to support that, and they have arguments that seem entirely reasonable to support it. But when you look at the anti-vaccination rhetoric, they have all of the same stuff. And the question is, how do you make a person literate enough to be able to navigate through those things? Also, how do you recognize that there are extra logical things going on? That is, there are concerns that parents have that more information doesn't simply make it go away. So parents will look for information that supports anxieties that they have, and when they find that, they will often seize on those arguments and give those arguments primacy. So if public health officials want to figure out how to address those, they've actually got to find out what is it that's motivating parents' concerns. So instead of arguing against the anti-vaccination people, probably a better use of time would be to look very carefully at what seems to be animating parents' concerns.
That's what's interesting to me about your book, Mark, is that you write about these irreconcilable sides, you know, the all-out vaccination and the anti-vaccine, but you also write about a group of people who you're describing there, not necessarily anti-vaccine, but vaccine anxious.
Yeah, that accounts for about 40% of today's parents of young children. So we know that 40% will report that they have conscientiously delayed or refused a recommended vaccine. So it's a huge number. There have always been anti-vaccinators. I mean, they've been with us since Edward Jenner's discovery of the smallpox vaccine, or invention of the smallpox vaccine. But they are a very small number. They're 2 to 3% of a population at any given time. They just all out say, I don't accept vaccines as a valuable tool for personal or public health. They are largely immovable. What we want to look at is that 40%, those people who are vaccine anxious, and ask how it is we can assure that they don't become anti-vaccinators. We want to prevent anti-vaccine anxious people from becoming anti-vaccinators.
You know what else is interesting to me about Abby's call? And thank you so much, Abby, for joining us. Marcella, I'll throw this to you. You know, Mark's absolutely right. You know, you can find everything, and both sides seem to be armed with all sorts of information. Here's what I wonder, Marcella. Is there, in general, less trust in authority these days than perhaps a generation or two ago? You know, in politics, in sports, in the Catholic Church with the child sex abuse scandal. I mean, no matter where you look, we've seen high authorities fall down, people who seemed trustworthy who turned out not to be. I wonder if that trust gap is extending to the medical profession, and that's what some of this anxiety is all about.
I'm not sure that it may be extending to the medical profession. I think it does extend to certainly government, and that's
the CDC, for example, which is sort of
CDC still seems to be relatively well placed. People still understand that they are, in terms of science and medicine, they're still held in pretty good esteem. The numbers show that. Probably not as high as we'd like. State government, I'm not sure that we're seen. When we look at those polls, we're not seen necessarily as the right place to look. But we, in our particular division of public health, we have taken the idea, and it's been told to us over and over again in the studies that we've done, and also in the studies of CDC. Yesterday, there was a whole webinar on this exact topic about how do we work with people who are vaccine hesitant. I mean, that was the topic yesterday. So how do we have a conversation with these people? And we believe that still the best person to have that conversation is the medical provider. So we continue to educate the medical provider so that they, in turn, who understand the parent, understand the child.
Got the relationship.
They have that relationship. So we push out resources to those physicians as often as we can. So I think the medical profession, or at least my medical provider, is still held in good standing. And whatever we can, we know that that's the relationship that is going to make or break.
Lots of people. Oh, I'm so sorry, Marcel. Lots of folks who want to jump in our conversation. And next is Bree in Keene. Hi, Bree. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't see this panel as very balanced at all in this discussion, unfortunately. There's so many issues with what your, quote, public health professionals are saying. I guess just to pinpoint one thing, my one question is, why is it that hepatitis B, that's primarily a blood-transmitted disease associated with lifestyle choice, intravenous drug use, unprotected sex, clearly not a children's disease, is part of the standard government-recommended vaccination schedule? And the first dose is given within the first 12 hours in the hospital. Secondly, and then I'll take my comments off the air, I believe your guest Mark, he's, you know, quote, saying anti-vaccine rhetoric and that parents aren't literate enough to explore these topics. When you're talking about parents, you're primarily talking about mothers because those are the ones who are making the choices. And I think that's a dangerous thing to say about mothers in the society in this time.
Well, Bree, I'm so glad you called because in your book, Mark, you talk specifically about this Hep B and your anxiety around giving it to your daughter, Annabelle, right after she was born. And you were kind of going, wait a minute, why am I doing this? So go ahead, Mark.
Well, thank you, Bree, for your questions. And Bree brought up a number of interesting points, and I'll talk about Hep B in a second. She's absolutely right that there's an interesting gender thing going on with the vaccines. 85% of healthcare decisions for children are made by the mothers.
Yeah, and you talk about that in the book, too, although you were a single dad, so you're
an
exception
single,
there.
And that's what made this a sort of an odd situation for me because I found myself thrown in as a man into a world of discussions that were primarily being held among women. So there is an interesting gender thing going on here. And there's and I think Bree pointing to the term literacy, science literacy or medical literacy, there is an interesting pattern that we see in the public discussion about this. This is that people who have anxieties about vaccines or who are anti-vaccinators are somehow either ignorant and they're missing some piece of information, so we must just educate them. We call it the a knowledge gap argument. So you and I disagree, and if I could just tell you this thing I know, you would suddenly drop all of your worries and you would accept my worldview. We know that never happens, but it's a very standard argument around things involving science and medicine and public discourse. So part of the argument here is to get away from the claim that I can convince you with evidence to change your worldview. It actually doesn't happen. People don't change their worldviews based on learning one new bit of information. And the hepatitis B vaccine is a great venue in which you see things like that happening. We do give hepatitis B at birth. Hepatitis B is a bloodborne disease, and we started doing it in 1994. The CDC started recommending it, and states started mandating that in the hours after birth, in a hospital setting, children be vaccinated against hepatitis B. Now, the reality is the vast majority of children who are vaccinated against hepatitis B are not in any immediate threat of contracting hepatitis B. It's not impossible for them to get it. And in fact, many children who aren't in immediate threat of getting it do end up contracting hepatitis B. But hepatitis B is one of those things like smallpox or like polio that if we can get it out of circulation among humans, we can get rid of it. So there's a kind of triumphalist potential with things like hepatitis B. But the problem is, once someone leaves the hospital with their child, we know that we've lost the moment to get universal vaccination. That's a really key moment. So the tactic to get rid of hepatitis B has been vaccinate at birth. And if we can get everyone vaccinated at birth, we can sort of get rid of it the way that we have gotten rid of polio in the United States. It's gone in the U.S. Now, that's not how we got rid of polio. We didn't do it with universal vaccination. And that's not how we got rid of smallpox. We did it with ring vaccinations, vaccinating around people who have it. But this has been the tactic, and this has animated a lot of anxiety among people. So while you're trying to achieve one end, get rid of hepatitis B, sometimes you're actually causing more problems with the people's worries about the vaccine schedule generally.
Yeah, Marcella, what do you think that, you know, not all vaccines are created equal, that there are some, sure, nobody wants to get smallpox, but, you know, there are others that maybe you don't need or that you don't need right now. You know, there's this idea that you got to get them all. Well, maybe not.
Vaccine is a preventative measure. If you were to not get it until you needed it, it's probably too late. So I received my hepatitis B as an adult because I worked in an environment that it was recommended. I wasn't a healthcare worker, but I was in that environment. And yes, I decided I was going to get that hepatitis B because there was that risk. Out there, there's that risk. So many of these things, sure, we don't want smallpox, we don't want polio, we don't want meningitis. But we can't say, oops, I may have gotten it, I have to run and get vaccinated today. That doesn't work. You have to have it before. You have to have it at least 2 weeks before you run into that person who happens to be walking down the street with meningitis or whatever the disease is. It's preventative. That means you have to get it before the possibility exists. So, of course, we want to protect these children well before any possible vaccine-preventable disease comes walking down the street.
Well, Breeze, good to hear from you. Thanks for adding your voice and your concerns to our conversation. We appreciate it. We will take more of your comments and questions after a break. We're going to check in now with our December Fun Drive.
And this is the next to last day for our short December fund drive. That's why we really do need to hear from you right now. Your support right now helps pay for the exchange in 2014, and it qualifies you for a tax-deductible gift to NHPR for 2013 when you call right now 1-888-805-6477 or donate online at nhpr.org. I'm Michael Rathke, and here with me is Virginia Prescott.
We're closing in on the December fund drive, their last chance to get into this action and to get a tax deduction for 2013. And right now, the last 21 minutes in which your name can be entered to win a $600 gift card to Burke Jewelers. That's in Nashua, right down on West Pearl Street. So we've been found out that you can get it definitely in time to finish your Christmas shopping for a very, very special gift for somebody on your Christmas list, $600 in gift cards to Burke Jewelers. So you can support NHPR by becoming a sustaining member now at 1-888-805-6477 or enroll online at nhpr.org and your name will be entered into the hat for that drawing. Call now.
And again, just 20 minutes left to go on this drawing, so get your name in the hat right now, nhpr.org, or call 1-888-805-6477. In these final days of the year, it's just natural for all of us to take a look back and look at all the big news stories that happened during the last year. When tensions with Syria were were running high. NHPR and NPR were there to bring you coverage. When the government was shutting down a couple of months ago, NHPR and NPR were there for you. When we've had winter storms hit New Hampshire in the last few days, NHPR has brought you coverage of the storms and the impact on the region as well. Your support this year in 2013 has made all these great stories, all this great coverage possible, and your support right now will ensure that we will continue to be there for you to bring the stories home to you that matter the most. Call right now. Give as generously as you can, 1-888-805-6477, or give online, nhpr.org.
And thanks to all of the Exchange listeners who have come through this morning. We started with an hourly goal of $3,500. Well, now we're down to $2,500. So we get there one phone call at a time. One person who decides, I'm going to be a supporter of New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm going to get behind the conversations that I hear on the Exchange, especially today, a pretty explosive issue, the issue of vaccines. But you're hearing a conversation that is civilized, that is reasoned, that gives a lot of different perspectives, and your perspective is among them. Call NHPR at 1-888-805-6477 or make a contribution at nhpr.org. We will get down from this $2,500 goal that we have for the next 18 minutes, and your name will be entered in to win a $600 gift card from Burke Jewelers.
Great time to call, 1-888-805-6477, nhpr.org. How much should you give? That is up to you. For most folks, it's usually $5 or $10 a month on the Sustainer Giving Plan here at NHPR. Some folks like to give a dollar a day. If you're in a position to make a Leadership Circle gift of $1,000 or more, and I know we've had several of those come in during this short December fund drive, your Leadership Circle support would encourage others to step forward and give as much as they can. That's how it works here at NHPR. We take all the dollars that are contributed and we pool them together, and that's how we bring you programs like The Exchange here on NHPR. So please take just a couple of moments now. Give as generously as you can at 1-888-805-6477 or make your tax-deductible gift online at nhpr.org.
And of course, that $1,000 Leadership Circle gift will help send NHPR into the new year of that much more support. And it would be your last chance to get a tax deduction for 2013. And only for the next 17 minutes when you call 1-888-805-6477 or contribute at nhpr.org. Your name is going to be entered to win a $600 gift certificate to Burke Jewelers, so you can pick out something very special for that very special person or for yourself. You just have to do it before 10 o'clock this morning. So Exchange listeners, support us now at 1-888-805-6477. Support your own listening at nhpr.org.
Time's running out to get your name in the hat for this $600 gift card from Burke Jewelers. The drawing is at 10 o'clock this morning. Time is running out, too, for this short December fund drive. We do need to hear from you with your support right now. 1-888-805-6477, nhpr.org.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from UR members and TransCanada Generating and Selling Electricity, and a proud supporter of New Hampshire Audubon's initiative to restore nesting bald eagles in the Connecticut River watershed. And from the Mount Washington Valley Chamber of Commerce and Visitors Bureau, providing information for your holiday shopping in North Conway, New Hampshire, online at shopmwv.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we dive back into what's behind the vaccine debate that's been ongoing for about 20 years. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guests for the hour are Mark Largent, historian of science and associate dean at Michigan State University. He's the author of Vaccine, The Debate in Modern America. Also with us, Marcella Babinski, Immunization Section Chief for the New Hampshire Division of Public Health Services. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. And both of you, here's an email that came in earlier from Jocelyn, who says, can you also speak about vaccines for the elderly? My 87-year-old mother-in-law and her slightly younger sister refuse to get any vaccines. Doesn't this affect the herd immunity? Again, that's from Jocelyn. Jocelyn, thanks a lot. And how about you, Mark? Do you want to take that one first?
Well, you know, most of my work is focused on childhood vaccines, and that's where the most public debate has focused. We've shifted to increasing the number of adolescents that we vaccinate, especially against things like meningitis. I'm on a college campus. My office is actually in a dorm. So things like meningitis spreading through a college community are, you know, a really serious problem. As you start aging, there are other sets of ailments that emerge. And the public conversation has really focused on getting adults to be revaccinated against pertussis by getting the DTaP shot. And that has to do with the fact that we had changed the way in which we vaccinated children against pertussis in the 90s. We went from a whole cell vaccine to an acellular vaccine, which just has parts of it in it. That's critical to get adults vaccinated or revaccinated against pertussis in protecting children, because whooping cough is very, very problematic, especially for young children. And one way to prevent its spread is to vaccinate adults to keep them from bringing it home, essentially. As you age further than that, the other issue that has come up lately has been the shingles vaccine. So if you contract chickenpox, after the symptoms go away, you still have the virus in your skin cells. And as you age and your immunity wanes, you'll get a reoccurrence of that virus in the form of shingles. And while chickenpox is dangerous to some, to the vast majority of people, it's at most a nuisance. Shingles is really problematic. About 20% of people who contract shingles end up with permanent damage from it. Usually it's neuralgia in their hands and feet, and the only treatment for that is narcotics. So you end up with these middle-aged and elderly people who contract shingles or develop shingles because they had chickenpox. So, and the results of it are deadly. I mean, they're really, really problematic. It's a much more problematic presentation than chickenpox is. So the shingles vaccine will help prevent that. We started giving that in 2006. There have been moments when it's actually hard to get. But it looks like it's online now and accessible. But that's one that you take to protect yourself rather than taking to protect other people.
And Marcella, there was an article in Scientific American last year casting doubt on how well the flu vaccine worked for the very young and the elderly. And yet we often hear every flu season, you know, that especially the elderly should get it, especially those because their immune systems may not be as strong. Some are living in group settings. But then there's been some doubt lately on whether the flu vaccine is even worth it for older people.
Worth it for older people is I understand the way a lot of people may look at it. If you can protect yourself 50% of the time, certainly then it's worth it to get the vaccine. But I do want to talk about, you know, there's a new vaccine out called a high dose, and it's four times more powerful than the vaccine that you and I might get. And that has been developed for the elderly because it does take that much more power, if you will, to make their systems create those antibodies. So we are looking at ways to make sure that vaccine is more powerful. And the other is the pneumococcal vaccine for the elderly. And again, that's because that is a population that tends to get pneumonia potentially more often. And so that is a vaccine that it's certainly highly recommended for the elderly.
So there's a pneumonia vaccine. Yes. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, it's a pneumovax. You get it as a child. We call that a Prevnar. That's the product name. And it's the pneumovax for the elderly. It can prevent 23 different types of pneumonia. I mean, these never come as a simple issue. There's 23 plus types of pneumonia that one can contract. So that's another very important vaccine for the elderly. And essentially, we know that hospitalizations based on pneumonia, hospitalizations based on influenza, those complications, they go sky high in that population. As a matter of fact, about this last year, about 69% of hospitalizations in 2012, 2013, that related to influenza were in that young children, 6 months to 4 years of age, and the elderly. They are a very vulnerable population. So, yes, we should be vaccinating the elderly, especially in assisted care facilities, nursing homes, because they are in a congregate facility.
All right, Jocelyn, I hope that helps. Thanks for the email. Let's take another call. Josh has been waiting in Berlin. Hi, Josh. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Hello to your guests. I'd just like to say that the Amish people, for example, they do not vaccinate, and they have a much less incident of autism. And also, there's a number of vaccines over the years that have been based or had like a preservative agent that was mercury-based, which we all know mercury in any amount is toxic to the human body. Now, there's an agent inside the vaccine itself that will enhance an immune response. And if you have 25 different vaccines coming at a child that I personally feel is excessive, these enhanced immune response can wreak havoc in a young child's developing and growing body. And the last thing I'd like to say is that the explosion in the cancer rate, and this isn't a vast right-wing conspiracy or just the ramblings of a paranoid. It's been documented that in the polio vaccine that was given back in the 50s, maybe as much as 50% of it was contaminated, because when they grew it on the organs of rhesus monkeys, there were certain cancers that were common to the monkeys that was not in our species, and that when it jumped to the human beings through the polio vaccine, they said that that could explain why we have such an explosion decades later of cancer. And I think it should be looked into, and I don't think these things are being irresponsible.
Yeah. No, I appreciate your call.
It to the fore.
Thank you very much for calling in. I appreciate what you say. And, you know, two of the things he said, Mark, you mentioned earlier, the concern about the autism link and the concern about mercury. Go ahead. And if you want to address the cancer concern, that's fine, too. Go ahead, Mark, please.
So there's a number of things that he raised, and this is part of the discourse that goes on outside of doctors' offices. So this is part of the public discourse we see that kind of weaves through, especially online conversations, but also in some print published places. So he started by talking about thimerosal. That's the preservative that was used in many childhood vaccines. This is a mercury-based preservative. And you know, beginning in the 70s, we have told each other and especially told parents that any exposure to heavy metals for children is really problematic. So lead, nickel, mercury, these are neurotoxins. They accumulate in people's bodies, and you want to avoid them because they do cause developmental delays and cognitive deficits. So we were kind of shocked when we realized, oh, we'd been using this in these vaccines and in things like tattoo inks really since the 30s. And we had put it in there because there had been a rash of viral infections in the 30s from vaccines, and this was a way to prevent when you have a multi-use vial. So you have a large vial of vaccines, and you're inserting needle after needle into that vial to pull out doses to give. Every time you put a needle in there, there's a chance that you're introducing a virus or a bacteria. So we need something in there to act as a preservative to prevent that from happening. And we'd use thimerosal for it. Now, the problem here is that mercury isn't just mercury. There's actually several different kinds of mercury, and the stuff that bioaccumulates in fish and then we eat and it becomes problematic is a form of mercury that's quite small, and our bodies are unable to get rid of it. The mercury that was used in thimerosal is a larger form of mercury. It's a larger molecule, and we can actually excrete it. So when you get a vaccine that had thimerosal in it, what we find is between 2 and 4 weeks later, all of it was out of your system. Your body was able to get rid of it. Now, when you have a two-week-old child, that 2 to 4 weeks is a long time.
Sure.
That's a big deal, right? So that made people nervous, and I don't think it's unreasonable.
To jump in here, and I do apologize because I have to wrap up for the hour. And Josh, I apologize for not letting Mark answer your last point, but I really appreciate you chiming in this morning. We did also get an email from Steve in Concord who says we can look back in time or look at the incidence of childhood disease and death in countries without vaccine to understand the risks. This understanding is why children with clinically trained health providers are vaccinated. Steve says it's unfair for unimmunized people to put others at risk, especially when their opposition is not scientifically based. So there's the other side of that. Clearly, folks, we're still having this debate. It's still ongoing. I really appreciate both of you coming in. I appreciate everybody who called and emailed with their questions and concerns. Marcella, thank you very much for being here. It was nice to meet you.
Thank you.
And Steve Largent, thank you also for your time.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
And listening to The Exchange on NHPR makes your time more valuable. Also, all the programs you listen to, whether you wake up to a Morning Edition, you listen during your commute, or on the weekend, we create that value with listener contributions. I'm Virginia Prescott. I am here with Michael Rathke and asking you to join us on our December fund drive, getting the money and the funding together for our next fiscal year, or for our next year. 1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org is the way that you can jump on that bandwagon. And we have a special reason to do it in the next 4 minutes and the next 4 minutes only. When you give, you will be entered to win a $600 in gift cards to Burke Jewelers. That's in downtown Nashua. The deadline is 10 o'clock, so call now, 1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org.
The deadline's 10 o'clock. That's just 4 minutes away. We need to hear from you now. If you want to get your name in the hat to win the $600 in gift cards from Burke Jewelers, pick up your phone right now, 1-888-805-6477. You can enter the drawing and support The Exchange as well online right now, nhpr.org. We are now down to 3 minutes left to go on this drawing. Don't put it off any longer. 1-888-805-6477, nhpr.org.
Now call us now at 1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org. We are now looking at a goal. We are $1,800 to go in the next 3 minutes. And in those next 3 minutes, you can make your tax-deductible contribution to New Hampshire Public Radio. Your name will be entered in to win $600 in gift cards to Burke Jewelers in Nashua, so you will have that in time for Christmas. Call us now at 1-888-805-6477. Somebody is going to win that $600 in gift certificates to Burke Jewelers. Why not let it be you? Imagine walking through and buying something sparkling for Christmas for yourself or for someone else.
1-888-805-6477, nhpr.org. Now just 2 minutes left to go to get your name in the hat for this great drawing happening right now, a $600 gift certificate to Burke Jewelers. 2 minutes left to go on this drawing, and you're also entered in for the rest of the drawings of this very short December fund drive, which ends tomorrow, by the way. So if you've been meaning this week to support The Exchange, make a tax-deductible gift in these final days of 2013, let's hear from you right now. 1-888-805-6477, nhpr.org.
Right, we're closing in on your last chance to send NHPR into the new year 2014 with your full support and also to get a tax deduction. And we're sweetening the pot today by making your, if you call within the next now 2 minutes at 1-888-805-6477 or contributing at nhpr.org, your name will be entered into the hat for a drawing to Burke Jewelers. And by the way, if you're a sustaining member of New Hampshire Public Radio, your name is entered into all of these drawings, but why not call now and support NHPR and get a tax deduction? 1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org.
Your support makes The Exchange possible. It also makes the Diane Rehm Show possible here on NHPR. And for us to be able to bring the Diane Rehm Show, we have to write a pretty hefty check to NPR. Next year alone, this check is going to top $350,000. So your support today in this next to last day of our December fund drive helps to ensure that we have all the dollars we need to pay for your favorite NPR programs like the Diane Rehm Show in 2014. Please call right now, 1-888-805-6477, nhpr.org.
If you love The Exchange, if you love the Diane Rehm Show, if you love taking part in the national and local conversations that you hear on New Hampshire Public Radio, this is time to support. We have a $1,700 goal to get to in a minute and a half, and just for the next minute and a half, when you make your contribution to New Hampshire Public Radio, your name will be entered into the drawing for a $600 gift certificate to Burke Jewelers. That's in Nashua, and we will make sure that you get it in time for Christmas. 1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org.
This is it. Your last chance right now to get your name in the hat for the $600 in gift cards from Burke Jewelers. 1-888-805-6477, nhpr.org.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. It's 10 o'clock, the Diane Rehm Show coming up. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Comcast Business, partnering with businesses of any size to provide scalable technology solutions that keep pace with growth and success. More at business.comcast.com. And the co-op food stores of Hanover, Lebanon, and White River Junction, purveying thousands of products from local food producers,